think there is a real possibility that we could have the first shots going into arms by the end of October if all goes according to plan. Now, we have to remember, too, that it's in theory possible that the FDA will come back and say we need more data, or that maybe only a smaller group of children, perhaps those with higher risk, may be initially approved. So this is not a given.
Dr. Lena Wen speaking on CNN about Pfizer's vaccine for kids. Pfizer and BioNTech have officially asked the FDA to approve their COVID vaccine for use in kids ages 5 to 11. If approved, more than 28 million children will be eligible for the shots, likely sometime between Halloween and Thanksgiving. The FDA is scheduled to meet on October 26th. This comes at a time when COVID cases in children rival those of adults in some parts of the country. Joining us now is Yvonne Maldonado, professor of pediatrics and epidemiology at the Stanford School of Medicine, and she also leads the pediatric Pfizer trials at Stanford. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, tell us about the trials for these children under the age of 12. You had, I understand, 2,000 kids who received two doses of the vaccine. What were the results?
So far, the data are still embargoed. They have been submitted to the FDA, and there's some high-level results. But basically, the studies were really looking for safety first, and then what we call immunobridging. That is the ability of the vaccine to induce antibody responses that were similar to those seen in older kids and adults. And it looks that, like, overall, that those goals were actually met, and the vaccines were overall found to be very safe and seemed to generate really good immune responses. So it'll be up to the FDA at this point to really weigh in, as you heard earlier, about more of the nuances.
Well, tell us about the dosing, because I understand you gave a lower dose in these trials to the children.
Yeah, so just to remind everybody, the dose that has been approved so far under emergency use for 12 to 15-year-olds is a 30 microgram dose per shot, and the same for the 16 and older. Now, remember, the 16 and older have full approval now and emergency use for 12 to 15. For the 5 to 11-year group, the dose that is being proposed is 10 micrograms, so one-third of the adult dose. And the reason is that the lower dose was able to provide the same degree of antibody responses that you saw with the higher dose with less side effects.
Huh. And so would that then follow for adults? You could have a lower dose and still be effective?
Yeah, I assume that if, you know, and this is up to, of course, the manufacturers, if they were interested in going back and vaccinating older individuals with lower doses to see if that worked, then I suppose that could be another consideration. Remember, the original studies were done with those other doses. I think we were in a much different place last year. We had no vaccine or prospects of them. We didn't know what these would look like. And I think they picked, the companies all picked doses that they thought provided good antibody responses and really launched into giving those doses to tens of thousands of people. So now that we have this data, it's possible that you could see the same good responses at a lower dose, not only improving the amount of vaccine available, which isn't as big a problem in the US, but could be an issue outside the US, but also could reduce the immediate side effects of people experience. Now, of course, we don't know that that's true, but it would be worth thinking about, absolutely.
Right, because in some cases, the second dose in particular has some pretty strong side effects, some people experiencing fever and definitely sore arm for a day or two, at least. So maybe that could be lessened with a lower dosage?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that has not been lost on, these companies, because it would be a great opportunity to get more people interested in getting the vaccine. Anything we can do to get people motivated to be vaccinated would be helpful. And you know, if we could reduce side effects, why not?
Well, then how does that square with some reports that the efficacy wanes with Pfizer, and Pfizer itself is saying that booster shots are necessary? And you see some research coming out that even sooner than 6 months, the efficacy wanes with the Pfizer vaccine.
So if you look at any vaccine, we know that over time, most likely you're going to see a reduction in antibodies. And one of the complications here is not only maybe there be a reduction in efficacy, but there may be also an impact of the Delta variant, which is so transmissible. You just may be seeing more cases anyway, higher viral loads, and more likelihood of getting infected even if you're vaccinated. So it's really been very difficult to tease out time since vaccination and impact of new variants that have shown up since vaccination. So those two factors are kind of tangled up together. But it is, I don't think anybody's surprised, or at least none of us who work with vaccines, I don't think we were surprised that there would be waning over time. The question really has to do with how long do you wait before you really need to boost somebody? And will you need more than one booster? And those are questions that we really don't know for sure at this point.
Getting back to vaccinations for children, how was the age group chosen, 5 to 11? Because it seems, I guess, not arbitrary, but it seems not to be necessarily based on physiology, but based on school age. So kindergarten through, what, fifth or sixth grade before middle school?
Yeah, you know, I think most trials are, in general, the FDA likes to see vaccine trials done by age groups, but they don't define the age groups for you. And so some of that is by convenience. Some of it could be strategic, like you said, maybe for school aged children versus younger. I don't really know how the ages were picked, but they generally fall into categories of adults, young adults, teenagers, older kids, toddlers, and then infants and young children. So that's kind of in general, and for every different vaccine, not just COVID, but other vaccines, as well as for the COVID vaccines, the ages can be rough. And frankly, the physiology of immune responses to vaccines is not really set in stone regarding, you know, a particular age or a particular weight or a size. They're really, each vaccine is different, and really the responses can be a spectrum over age and size and height and things like that. So there's no one cutoff. So I think the important thing is once they make a definition that they stick to it and really track within that age group, the vaccine trials. So in this case, I think I really don't know how they went, for example, got to 16. I'm glad they did, because now we have vaccines for some of the young people. And then 12 to 15, you know, again, who knows how those numbers came up, but they don't, they're not really out of the range of norm, what you'd expect an immune response to be.
So we can expect some action, hopefully, by Thanksgiving from the FDA on this. And very quickly, we have just a few seconds left. Any idea when we might have a vaccine for even younger children, 0 to 4?
Yeah, so we're one of the Pfizer sites here at Stanford, and we've been working really hard to make sure we get enough children in, and the families and the kids have been great. But we're really focusing on trying to finish the 5 to 11-year-old just to get the FDA review done. But we're already enrolling the under fives, the 6-month-old to 40, to under 5-year-old kids. And we'll really start taking that up more seriously once the FDA reviews and we can really get to work on the younger children. So I would imagine we won't have any data before the end of the year for the younger children, just given all of the emphasis on the older kids.
Okay, well, we'll check back in with you then. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, sure, no problem. Thank you so
That's
much.
Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, professor of pediatrics and epidemiology at the Stanford School of Medicine. Well, in other vaccine news, a major announcement from the World Health Organization's Director General yesterday.
I started my career as a malaria researcher, and I longed for the day that we would have an effective vaccine against this ancient and terrible disease. And today is that day, an historic day.
An historic day. The WHO approved the first ever vaccine for malaria. The disease kills hundreds of thousands of people every year, mostly children. And we're going to talk about what this vaccine could mean for the developing world with Dr. Sunil Parikh, professor of epidemiology and infectious diseases at the Yale School of Public Health. He has spent most of his career studying malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Great to have you back. Well, what do you make of this news?
It's super exciting. I think the director general said it best. I mean, this is a disease that has been with us for thousands of years, literally, and has probably killed more individuals than any single infectious disease in our history. So to be at this point now, finally, where we have a vaccine that can reduce its toll on kids is really something to celebrate.
And why kids in particular? And first of all, why does the disease mainly kill children?
Yeah, it's this disease, you know, you could think of it roughly more than 90% of it occurs in Africa. And certainly about 90% or more of the cases and deaths occur in children, particularly those at the youngest ages. And this disease carried by mosquitoes, really only by mosquitoes. Kids are infected with this over and over again. And with that, over the course of your lifetime, you do develop some immunity to the disease, but you're never fully immune to it. So the first few times you get it when you're a child, you're at the highest risk of getting really sick and dying. So that's why this vaccine really has been targeted to kids, because they get the most disease, and when they get sick, they have the highest chance of dying. And that's in Africa is predominantly where this is occurring. So that's why the vaccine's really been focused here and tested here.
Why is it predominantly in sub-Saharan Africa?
So it, you know, I should say it is all over, you know, probably 50% of the planet is at risk or in areas where malaria is transmitted. But in Africa, it's a very different situation because the mosquitoes that are in this area combined with the temperature and other kind of environmental factors really make it a perfect storm situation for the malaria parasite and its transmission.
Hmm. So tell me about the vaccine, how it works.
Yeah, so this vaccine targets the liver stage of the parasite. One of the complicating things with malaria is it does a lot of different things in the mosquito, and it does a lot of different things in the human. So on the human side, after we get bit by a mosquito, the parasite then travels to our liver, and from there it goes on and infects our red blood cells. And that's when you feel sick. But this vaccine targets the liver stage of the parasite. And the idea is that hopefully by attacking the parasite there, it will have less chance of getting out and getting into the blood and thereby protect people from both disease and severe, you know, mild disease and severe disease. So it's a vaccine that has been really in development since the 1980s. And this was one of the first strategies that people had to really move forward with on the vaccine front. And you know, after all that time, it's exciting to see that it's come to fruition.
Why did it take so long?
This parasite, again, is extremely clever. It's evolved with us for thousands of years, literally. It's figured out ways to evade our immune system. It's one of the most kind of flexible parasites or pathogens that I can think of, really. It's very good at hiding from our immune system so that when the immune system figures out the parasite is there, it's able to really change its coding so that the next time the immune system attacks, the parasite may look different. The other challenge is that it really does do very different things at different points in its life cycle. So like I said, you have stages in the liver, in the blood cells, and they all pose unique challenges for the immune system. So trying to figure out how best to attack it, where to attack it, and cover all the variation that is out there has proven to be really, really difficult. And that will continue to be a challenge.
However, I understand that this vaccine is only about 30% effective, which doesn't seem like a lot in this age of COVID vaccines. And it requires up to 4 doses. And then the protection fades after a few months. So, as you say, it's not perfect.
Yeah, I'd like to think of this vaccine as one tool in the toolbox. You know, it's going to be important. It is important already. It's going to be used in addition to our bed nets that we use all over Africa. It's going to be used in some places in addition to giving a medication like we do in West Africa at monthly intervals to reduce malaria, possibly. That might be one use. So it's a tool in the toolbox, and you're right. I must say, while we're all super excited, we're humbled by the fact that this vaccine is maybe only 30, 40, 50% effective at best at reducing malaria. And after a few years, that goes down a lot. So I think the challenge that we're going to face, and we're seeing a similar, not exactly the same, but similar challenge with COVID is, when will we need a booster? How many years will this work? Do we need to then do a second round later on? Probably not. I think we will have to see, because this is still early days. But I think this proof of principle at least gives us hope that we're going to improve upon it. And I really do think we will. That'll be a few years away at least. But, you know, it really gives us something to build upon. The four doses is a challenge too, like you said. We have to give three doses consecutively at monthly intervals and then a fourth dose later on. I think kind of the silver lining there is the African community, the ministries of health and the WHO have worked so hard over so many years to make vaccination just part and parcel of bringing healthcare to the community. So this vaccine can really just be entered into that larger picture. And I think that's already been demonstrated in these pilot studies where they've been, even in the face of COVID, been able to roll out these vaccines. And the uptake and safety have been great. There hasn't really been this kind of hesitancy. People know, they see malaria day in and day out, how bad it is, and they want to protect their kids. So, you know, we really haven't seen that hesitancy at this point. Of course, something to continue to monitor, but the four doses, not great. We'd like to have it be less. But I think on the silver lining, we can roll it into things that are already really well accepted and that they're equipped to handle and do very well.
Dr. Sunil Parikh is an epidemiologist at the Yale School of Public Health who studies malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. Dr. Parikh, thank you for joining us.
Take care.
You think we have problems with the supply chain? Try being in Britain with the added bonus of Brexit. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. American consumers are dealing with supply chain shortages and disruptions these days, and so are British consumers, with an added twist. Labor shortages due to Brexit. The UK exited the European Union at the beginning of the year, and more than a million European workers left the UK. And that means there aren't enough blue-collar workers, such as truck drivers. So gas stations aren't getting regular deliveries of fuel, and that's caused some long lines and a few brawls at some gas stations. There are also reports of grocery stores running low on some items they can't easily replace now. Stephen Castle is the New York Times correspondent in London. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, describe the situation as you've seen it.
A bit of normal life is starting to reopen. If you go into the big cities, there are many more people around. Restaurants and bars are open, and things seem a little bit normal. But yet, as you say, at the same time, we've had this chronic shortage of truck drivers here in particular, and that's been the problem. Truck drivers to get food to supermarkets, and particularly to get gasoline to gas stations. So that's the normal situation. We this week, although Boris Johnson was doing his big speech at the party conference, the same day that the Tories were getting into their stride at their big meeting, military drivers were driving tankers here with gasoline.
Right. So the military is being used to deliver the gas now, the fuel, because there aren't enough truck drivers?
That's correct. I mean, it's just getting it from those refineries to the gas stations. And that has, although the situation has improved quite a lot, there's still problems, particularly in London and the south of the country.
Which, ironically, voted against Brexit.
Indeed. And Brexit really is one of the main reasons for this crisis. In terms of truck drivers, there are a couple of other. I mean, there's a long standing problem because Britain has too few truck drivers, has had too few truck drivers for a long time. Post-Brexit, the whole employment situation has changed because before Brexit, a British company could employ a European Union worker. That's somebody, for example, from Poland, from the Czech Republic, from Romania or Bulgaria. They could employ them, bring them to Britain and employ them with almost no paperwork. That situation has completely ended, and now those workers would require a work visa, just as an American who wanted to work in Britain would require a work visa, or a Briton who wanted to work in America would do. So that is an enormous change in the structure of the labor market, and it's been done really without a lot of foresight or a lot of forward planning.
And what other industries are seeing shortages in labor?
The other industry that's been particularly affected at the moment is meatpacking. There's a crisis there because a lot of meatpacking workers were people who come from Eastern Europe. Again, a number of those went home during the pandemic, and it's now impossible to hire them without going through all the process of getting a visa, etc. And as a result of that, a bad situation on a number of pig farms were because the farmers cannot now sell their pigs for food production, and they're having to shoot them on farms and dispose of them. And so this is the other big crisis that's happening in the last week.
So how many animals have had to be slaughtered?
Well, in the moment, it's not huge, but it's several thousands. And there are warnings that they're going to be potentially tens of thousands. But there's an overall problem in the labor market. And the government really hasn't gripped it with any sort of strategy.
Right. So I'm sure you're also experiencing a shortage in restaurants as we are here. Again, I'm sure you relied heavily on foreign waiters and waitresses and cooks who aren't there anymore or who don't want to work in restaurants anymore. And I'm wondering what the reaction is amongst regular Britons. Are they seeing price increases? Are they feeling panicked? Are they doing some panic buying?
Well, the main panic buying was on gasoline. But I do think there is a considerable worry that things will get very difficult as we go through the fall and into the winter months, particularly with prices rising. And the rise in inflation is potentially very worrying for a number of people at a time when all the support that was provided by the government during the pandemic, including for people on welfare, is being withdrawn. For the government, it's worrying that we hit this winter period, particularly as there's a spike in energy prices too. So it could be a very difficult winter for a number of people and also for the government.
I want to play a clip of tape of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He pushed for Brexit and he spoke yesterday at the Conservative Party's annual conference. You were there, and here is a bite from what he said.
That was the change that people voted for in 2016. And that was the change that people voted for again powerfully in 2019. And to deliver that change, we will get on with our job of uniting and levelling up across the UK.
What does he mean by levelling up across the UK?
What he means is spreading prosperity, because in Britain, London and the South East is the most prosperous part of the country, and a number of the post-industrial towns and cities in the North have been a bit left behind. They're sort of the equivalent of the Rust Belt areas of the United States. And the idea is to spread some of that prosperity. And this is one of the reasons that the government has been very reluctant to allow more foreign workers in, because Boris Johnson's argument is that British industry should just pay British people more money. And if British industry does that, then people will do these jobs. But that is his vision of an economy where, with less immigration and with higher wages for British workers.
But so far that hasn't happened.
Well, so far that hasn't happened. And a lot of people worry about the tone of the government's approach, and it's hostility to business. And this goes really back to the Brexit debate, because big business didn't want Brexit in the first place. There hasn't really been, the government hasn't really been listening to the warnings from business. And of course, it's very difficult to create a prosperous, productive, you know, high productivity, high wage, high growth economy if you don't have business on board doing the things that business needs to do. And so one of the commentators put it in one of the newspapers today, we know that Boris Johnson is fantastic at giving this great picture of the destination for the British economy. The worry is whether he actually has a map to get Britain there.
Stephen Kessel is the New York Times correspondent in London. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, there's a strict hierarchy in the Mormon Church, but a small faction is bucking the leadership on vaccines.
The image of the leaders sitting at this event was very striking. They were all wearing masks and maintaining social distance, and it was clearly intended as a message.
Trouble on the Mormon Church's right flank. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, more commonly known as the Mormon Church, has become a microcosm of the nation's divisions over COVID vaccines. Back in August, church leaders put out a statement urging members to get vaccinated. A recent survey found that most members support vaccines, about 65%. But a small vocal group of anti-vax members was furious to hear that their church was recommending vaccinations. For some, it was the first time they felt a real disagreement with their faith leaders. But those divisions are similar to ones more left-leaning members of the church have been feeling for a long time over the church's stance on LGBTQ rights. Joining us now is Emily Kaplan, a journalist who recently wrote about this for the Washington Post magazine. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's talk about this smaller group of anti-vax church members. They likely found themselves in disagreement with their leaders for the first time ever. How big is this group? And I'm surprised to come to the understanding that this is the first time they've come to any disagreement with the church over its pronouncements.
Right. Well, I can't say for sure whether this is the first time that, you know, members who are opposed to this particular statement find themselves in opposition to statements from the prophet and other church leaders. But it does speak to a growing problem, frankly, that the church is facing, which is the rise of a group called Deseret Nation, which goes by the hashtag DesNat on Twitter. And it's an alt-right group of Latter-day Saints or Mormons, who are generally aligned with other alt-right groups in the U.S. right now, but are really facing what I call in my piece cognitive dissonance, because they have to decide, as one woman I spoke to, who herself is very left-leaning, said, who they have to listen to more, the prophet or Tucker Carlson.
Describe, if you could just step back a little bit and describe what the relationship is between the prophet, the church is led by someone called the prophet, and this is Russell M. Nelson, the relationship between him and the flock, if you will, the church members, and how it may differ from, let's say, Catholicism, because lots of Catholics disagree with the Pope, but it isn't cause for enormous alarm. Why is it so important that the members of the church follow what the prophet says?
Right. So the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is often colloquially known as the Mormon Church, although church leaders have requested that people not refer to them as Mormons or the church as the Mormon Church, they believe in what they call continuing revelation, which is that there is a living prophet who speaks directly to God on behalf of the entire Latter-day Saint community. And when the prophet says something, when he receives revelation from God, Latter-day Saints are expected to listen. It's an institution that's extremely organized and extremely hierarchical. So there's a prophet, there's also apostles, and there are many senior leaders of the church, and it's incredibly organized down to the local level. So a key principle in the faith is obedience, and that means listening to church leaders. And so it's a really significant moment of tension when there's a significant number of people who would consider themselves Orthodox or very devout Latter-day Saints who have decided that they don't necessarily think that they should be listening to their prophet. That's, as far as I know, one of the first times in Mormon history in which the right-leaning contingent of the community has expressed vocal disagreement with their own leadership.
Fascinating. And what does the leadership say about that?
So it's interesting because this past weekend was General Conference, which is a weekend-long event in which senior leaders of the church give speeches to the faithful in their community, and also, you know, reaching out to the world at large to some extent, but that's not the primary purpose. And the leaders sent a very, very clear message that they were vaccinated and they wore masks. And so the image of the leaders sitting at this event was very striking. They were all wearing masks and maintaining social distance, and it was clearly intended as a message.
A message that this is where we are, please get in line.
Correct, yeah.
You write that this church is also very much twinned with the idea of the United States and places a lot of faith in the Constitution, in the U.S. Constitution, almost as an article of faith. How does it see itself in relationship to the U.S. and politically?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a complicated question. And I should emphasize that I am not a Latter-day Saint, and so I can't speak as a believer or as a member of this community, but I think it is generally agreed upon that Mormonism, which is the term that refers to the culture at large, as well as the history and the theology, is uniquely American. A lot of people call it the most American religion. And it's had a very complex history. You know, when it was founded, it was polygamous. And it's done a pretty serious about face because now it's a culture and a theology and an institution that's thought of as being highly aligned with, quote unquote, the traditional family or, quote, Republican family values. But that wasn't always the case. However, in the past few decades, the church has come to be tightly aligned with the Republican Party, including a very famous statement in 2008 that Latter-day Saints should do, quote, all that they can do to pass Proposition 8 in California, which guaranteed that marriage was between only a man and a woman. The church claims that it is apolitical, but its actions over the past several decades are not actually in line with that. But you know what? The tension that's evident right now may show that might be changing.
Well, you mentioned Proposition 8, which passed in California and obviously was overturned by state law. But let's talk about the church and its relationship to the LGBTQ community, because there are a lot of liberal members of the church who were not in line with their support for Prop 8. So how did they justify their parting with the church doctrine on that issue?
Right. It was fascinating. In my piece, I speak about Matt Marostica, who was taking over as bishop, which is a lay leader of the ward or congregation in Berkeley. And he received the edict from his superiors in the church that he should support a statement that encouraged all Latter-day Saints to, quote, do all that they can do. And he took a pretty legalistic view of this, and he said, well, if all that you can do is nothing, then that's fine. You're doing all that you can do. If all that you can do is to not publicly denigrate the leaders of our church, then you're doing great. That's all that you can do. So it was clear, you know, that there are ways to get around that for very liberal people in California. And certainly the Bay Area was sort of the height of this, but it happened in LA and in other liberal areas as well.
So I wonder if the members of the alt-right part of the church who are resisting the vaccine order, or I don't know how you want to characterize it, but, you know, the prophets urging that people take the vaccine, if their resistance to that, if they took a page from the left-leaning members and what they did around Prop 8.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's very insightful. Absolutely. Yes. It's a history that's now being repeated in perhaps an unexpected way. I also want to emphasize that one thing, which is that Russell M. Nelson, the current prophet of the church, was a very esteemed heart surgeon, you know, before he became prophet. And so he is seen as a medical authority. And so it's even harder to disagree with medical advice that he gives out because of his background and authority in that area.
Mm-hmm. There's something called personal revelation in the church, right? That people can use to say, well, I had this personal revelation, so therefore I'm going to part ways from the official dogma.
Right. There's what I call in the piece a theological mechanism called personal revelation, which is the ability for individual believers to receive revelation, which is communication directly from God. Traditionally, leaders have always said, well, personal revelation has to align with what we're saying. You know, you can't have personal revelation that's in contradiction to prophetic revelation. But that's really being challenged, or that's what I saw in my reporting and from my dozens and dozens of interviews with very knowledgeable people, is that that seems to be a fulcrum which some Latter-day Saints are using to say, well, you know, I may be gay, and that's against church policy at the moment to have a sexual relationship with someone of the same sex, but I received revelation from God that I will still be able to enter what they call the celestial kingdom, which is the highest tier of heaven in their theology.
Well, I mean, could that be used to justify anything you want to do that is frowned upon in the church?
Well, I think that's what leaders worry. You know, it's complicated. Right. And there are much more nuanced discussions being had about this. But looking sort of from the 10,000 foot view, that is a danger. And, you know, some people think that that's a good thing and some people think it means doom. But yes, it's certainly a point of tension.
Well, the church, most churches, most institutions, if they don't adapt to the times, they don't do well. And so is this something that church leaders are saying, well, okay, we do need to be more flexible, given the fact that there are these strong feelings on both sides, and we want to maintain our membership and our power, we're going to have to bend a little.
You know, church leaders would never tell me that. The institution is very opaque, and they say in many different ways that they are concerned only with God's messaging. You know, church history has shown at times of great societal tension, which placed the institution in conflict with society, changes have been made. Now, some people would argue that has nothing to do with the times. Some people will say it clearly does. You know, but at the beginning of the church's history, the prophet received a revelation in 1890 that the church needed to outlaw polygamy. You know, at the same time, the United States government was making it clear that polygamy was the issue that was preventing Utah, which is where the Latter-day Saints lived at the time, from becoming a state. So, you know, some people say, well, that's awfully convenient that the prophet received this revelation. And, you know, then Utah was able to achieve statehood. Others say, you know, that's not the correct way of understanding it. But clearly, the church does have to contend with society at large.
How big are these factions on the left and the right, do you think? And is the church in danger of a schism?
It's hard to say. There are a lot of sociologists, historians, And other analysts looking at this phenomenon right now, you know, being DESNAT or a member of quote unquote DESNAT, is not something that's being put out on census forms, for instance, you know, or not something that people readily identify with necessarily. So it's hard to measure. But I think it's fair to say that the far left and the far right are pulling on the cohesion of the church in a sort of tug of war with the political reality of the United States right now. Whether the church is facing a schism or whether it faces the possibility of becoming an ethno-religion, like Judaism, in which people will say, well, I'm culturally Mormon, but I don't follow today's prophet, I don't know. You know, people discuss that as a possibility. I think arguments could be made to support lots of predictions about the future, but I think it is very clear that the church is at an inflection point. Where it will go in the future remains to be seen.
Well, Emily, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Emily Kaplan, journalist and the writer of this week's cover story for the Washington Post magazine called The Rise of the Liberal Latter-day Saints. Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here with some suggestions for where to eat during Dine LA. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chop?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bad like that.
Pie.
Well, it's a special time of year for foodies here in L.A. Dine L.A. Restaurant Week is back. Diners can try special offerings at more than 250 restaurants. And restaurants get a chance to attract new customers and old ones after what has been quite a tumultuous year and a half for the L.A. restaurant scene. Evan Kleinman is here to talk about this. She's the host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi.
Hi.
Well, you joined us for Restaurant Week earlier this year, so it's actually not just 1 week.
Yeah, it's 2 weeks twice a year.
Okay, so Restaurant Weeks, but that doesn't have the same panache as Restaurant Week, I guess. 250, that's a lot, but you're going to focus in on a couple of genres, right?
Yeah, the last time we talked back in January about Dine LA, we focused on women-owned restaurants. And this time I thought I would go in the direction of pure comfort for many people and give Italian restaurants and steakhouses a nod.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good. That's like retro in a nice, comforting way.
Yeah, and with the weather getting just a little bit cooler, I think it's the perfect kind of thing to eat, too.
Okay, we're going to get to your recommendations in a moment. But first, let's get to the mechanics of how this works. Do most of these restaurants offer special menus during this restaurant week?
Yes, that's how it works. All the restaurants are open for regular business. But if you go in for Dine LA, you'll be offered a streamlined menu to choose from that is usually a prefix menu with several choices.
And about how much does it cost?
So the prices vary from a low of $15 to $25 for lunch to a high of $55 to $90 for dinner menus.
And you're getting mini courses for that price.
Yeah, yeah. And they're very nice meals. And some of them include alcohol. And then, of course, there are a few that have additional little goodies that you can order as a supplement.
Okay, so let's talk about your list. You've narrowed the recommendations down to 3 steakhouses to begin with. Which ones do you recommend?
I mean, the 3 steakhouses I've recommended are Gwen, Matu, and the Bearish. The Bearish at the Hollywood Roosevelt is Nancy Silverton's latest Los Angeles-based endeavor. So that would be fun to go to. I mean, the hotel is always gorgeous, and the restaurant's tucked in there in the lobby. And I would say that with Gwen, you know, you expect a restaurant with its own butcher shop to offer great steaks on the menu. And both Curtis Stone and his brother Luke started their careers in butcher shops. So that would be an excellent place to just really splash out.
What was the third one?
Matu. And Matu's an interesting restaurant. It's built upon grass-fed Wagyu from New Zealand. Theirs is at the high end, the menu. It's a $90 menu, but it's a five-course meal. And the main course rotates nightly between steak cooked on the plancha, over an open fire, and braised beef. And just so people know who are interested in Matu, the Dinelli dinner is for a minimum of two guests.
Okay, Matu, that is spelled M-A-T-U. Is it hard to get reservations when it's this week, this special week?
I don't know. I would say that probably not. You know, restaurants are still hurting in L.A., and Dine L.A. is a way for them to bring in people who haven't been before or regulars who have forgotten about them.
Okay, so steak houses, the Bearish, Gwen, Matu. Moving on to Italian restaurants, you have four to recommend.
Yeah, for Italian, I've picked out Brera, Factory Kitchen, Ospi, and Rosso Blu.
Okay, let's go down the list.
So you might remember that we talked about Cacio e Pepe the other week, and Brera mm-hmm. in the Arts District is offering that on their $45 three-course lunch menu. They also have a $65 dinner, which includes roasted bone marrow, a pasta course, grilled swordfish, and a lemon semifreddo. I love Brera. Mm. I also really love Factory Kitchen, which is just such a skillful place of pasta. And I have to say that their choices are quite expansive for the fixed meal. And they're offering, in addition to pasta, porchetta or fish on both their lunch menu and their dinner menus.
I always thought it was porchetta. It's porchetta?
Yeah, there's no K in the Italian language. C-H is K.
Okay, now I've learned something yet again, as I always do from you in these segments.
I'm sorry.
Okay, tell us about Ospi.
So Ospi is where you would want to go for something more casual. It's in Venice. They're offering a $25 lunch, and they have a selection of antipasti for the first course. They're known for their fried provolone and their eggplant parmesan or meatballs. It's followed by a choice of a big salad, a pasta dish, pizza, or several sandwiches that you can choose from. And then they have a supplement for dessert, which is a cannoli, which I would definitely just, you know, spend the extra $4 and get myself a cannolo.
Of course. I know how to pronounce that and how to eat it. Okay, Rosso Blu.
So Rosso Blu has been around for a while now. They're so good. And they're offering up a $55 three-course meal for dinner with antipasti choices like panzanella, swordfish spiedini, and prime beef carpaccio, followed by a second course of either flounder, duck breast, or kabocha squash crepes. Mmm, that sounds so good. Mm. And dessert is an apple brown butter crostata.
That sounds incredible. All right, you have given us just a few, but there are, as we said, 250 plus restaurants. How do you recommend people go about choosing what to try amongst all of those choices? It seems overwhelming.
So the thing about the Dine LA website is that the filters are really fantastic. So you are able to look at these restaurants via a neighborhood filter, a cuisine type filter, or a price filter. So it's really easy, actually.
Okay, that's the Dine LA website. And speaking of websites, your list is up at our website at kcrw.com. So that's a good place to start. Evan, what is on your show this week?
Well, we're down to the Fuerte Four of the Tortilla Contest, which, of course, is coming up this Sunday at Smorgasburg. So I'll be there live along with Gustavo and two other judges, Connie Alvarez from KCRW and Mona Holmes from Eater, and we would love to see you there. We also have a really great roundup of the best boba spots in the SGV. Bill Addison, the LA Times restaurant critic, reviews flavors from afar with monthly rotating menus from refugees and immigrants. You know, we have this weekly segment on Good Food called In the Weeds, in which I kind of step out of the way and we let restaurant people tell their own stories. And this week we're featuring the owners of Love to Eat in Hollywood, a much beloved Thai restaurant.
Sounds delicious. All right. Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear on Saturday at 11 o'clock right here on KCRW. Evan, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Okay, that does it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, if you want to hear the show all over again, or if you missed a certain part, or if you want to hear another show, you can do that. You can download our podcast at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.